Welcome to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast. It's for the week ending June 18th, and this is podcast number 92. I'm Joe Elia. There's a JAMA study this week showing that it's safe to use low-dose oral corticosteroids in acute exacerbations of COPD. The researchers found that most of the time, patients get the high-dose intravenous approach, but that's got problems of its own. We'll talk with the first author after this news roundup. Lancet Oncology has an article pointing to a modest increase in cancer risk after the use of angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. The number needed to treat to cause an excess cancer case was calculated by the authors to be 143 patients treated for 4 years. Since the overwhelming majority of patients in the studies analyzed were using telmisartan, an editorialist advises caution with this drug and advises that clinicians reserve the use of ARBs for patients who can't tolerate ACE inhibitors. Speaking of cancer risks, there's a consensus report from the American Diabetes Association and the American Cancer Society warning of an increased association between some types of diabetes and diabetes treatments and cancer. The increased risks are modest, for example, roughly a twofold increase in risk for pancreatic and endometrial cancers. But these aren't diseases that you want to increase your risks for. The associations advise simple awareness at this point, while confirmatory research gets done. Back to ARBs. The FDA has announced a safety review of olmesartan, marketed as Benicar, because ongoing studies in patients with type 2 diabetes show an increased risk for cardiovascular death. Right now, the FDA says the benefits of the drug outweigh the risks and asks that adverse events with the drug be reported to its MedWatch program. All right, that's enough news. Let's go to our conversation. This week, JAMA has a paper on COPD that may change your usual practices. Published guidelines advise that patients having exacerbations of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, but not those sick enough to have landed in the ICU, should receive oral corticosteroids as their initial therapy. However, clinicians, for their own reasons, seem to most often ignore this advice. Over 90% of the time, therapy begins with higher-dose intravenous therapy. The JAMA paper looks at the outcomes of some 80,000 patients in over 400 U.S. hospitals, most of whom were started on intravenous therapy, and finds that the guidelines are right. There was no advantage to starting IV. Here for this week's conversation is Dr. Peter Lindenauer, who's the director of the Center for Quality of Care Research at the Bay State Medical Center in Springfield, Massachusetts, an associate professor of medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine, and also the first author of the JAMA study. Welcome, Dr. Lindenauer.
Well, happy to be here.
I want to ask right away, were you surprised at how widely the guidelines are ignored in this situation?
Well, to be honest, the hunch that we had was that in spite of the recommendations contained in the guidelines, that we would observe more or less what we found. That is, our own experiences working in hospitals for many years led us to believe that most of the time patients were being started on higher doses of intravenous.
You looked at a composite primary outcome of treatment failure, and that included mechanical ventilation, the need for mechanical ventilation after the second hospital day, inpatient death, and the need for readmission within 30 days of the index admission for this exacerbation. And you found that for the most part, the people started on low dose, and there weren't many of them. There were roughly 8% of everybody started on low dose. They had no greater danger for encountering a treatment failure than the people who started on intravenous.
That's true. That observation held true even after adjusting for differences in the patient populations who were treated with IV or PO steroids.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's an important point to be made, and you know, it might come up later in our discussion, but this was an observational study and not a randomized trial, and it's important for listeners to think about the kinds of biases that might be present in a study like this. And, you know, the one that we were most concerned about was the possibility that when patients presented to the hospital with an acute exacerbation, that sicker patients would be more likely to get treated with intravenous therapy. And so there was an inherent selection bias favoring oral therapy. And most of the statistical analyses that we carried out in the study were intended to reduce the threat of bias related to this, you know, issue of sometimes called confounding by indication, in which, you know, the decision to use oral or intravenous therapy would be very influenced by the severity of the patients at presentation. And even though we went to sort of extensive efforts to control for those confounding, the possibility of that type of confounding, I think it is important for listeners to be aware that, again, it is an observational study, and the results do need to be interpreted somewhat cautiously.
Fair enough. And we should also point out that these patients were not patients who landed in the ICU. These are, you know, if anything is routine about an exacerbation of COPD, these were for the most part, the people who came in, presented, were treated, and didn't end up going to the ICU. So they were not in great danger.
That's very true. But it's also important to be aware that it's only a small percentage of patients who are hospitalized with COPD that get hospitalized and get admitted directly to the ICU. So that the patients that we study, by, you know, far and away represent the typical patients, mm-hmm. who are hospitalized for treatment of acute exacerbation.
The editorialists who write about your paper say that it would be difficult to set up yet another study of this question, and their recommendation is, for the most part, to follow the guidelines, to take your data for what they're worth until more studies can be done, or until some of these collaborative databases, which is the source of your information, can observe this in an ongoing way. I'd like to spend just a minute for you to describe how you got so many patients, how you get 80,000 patients, and 144 hospitals. What is that database that you used?
Sure. It was just to make a minor correction. Mm-hmm. You know, we studied close to 80,000 patients at over 400 hospitals.
Oh, sorry, you're right.
And these are hospitals that participate in the Premier Healthcare Alliance's prospective database, mm-hmm. which is a database that exists to support quality improvement efforts at participating institutions. And there are similar databases that exist today that have membership that involve university medical centers and pediatric hospitals, just to name a couple. Mm-hmm. I think what you know, the editorialists described was looking sort of to the next version of these kinds of data set that will presumably be the fruit of the labor to implement electronic medical records across the nation's hospitals. And so, you know, I think there's great hope both in the research community, in the quality improvement community, and in, you know, in Washington, that electronic medical records will help catalyze high-quality observational studies of comparative effectiveness and of treatment effectiveness. And so what Drs. Krishnan and Malarski wrote about was the, you know, possibility of studying changes in practice using those kinds of enriched or enhanced registry data. And they did, as you point out, they suggested that, you know, given the guideline recommendations and based on the evidence provided through our study, that it was reasonable to encourage more physicians to prescribe steroids at lower doses and administered through oral routes, with the caveat that the outcomes associated with that practice change are monitored closely. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where there's a tremendous opportunity to use EMR data and other kinds of enhanced administrative data to carry out high-quality observational studies. And the reason is, and I think you touched on this, and certainly the editorial did, that there are just, you know, way too many questions in clinical medicine that need to be answered that far exceed our ability to fund the clinical trials necessary to answer them all through the randomized trial mechanism. And I think in the editorial, they roughly estimated that to carry out this study as an RCT would require 30,000 patients and would take many years and many, many millions of dollars. And, you know, if you think of this as just one very basic question that practicing physicians have to sort of grapple with on a day-to-day basis, you know, you could quickly see how the RCT approach is not going to kind of get us all the answers that we need.
The answer to my next question may be obvious to the listeners, but if the outcomes are no different between the two approaches, what are the dangers of using the intravenous route?
Well, I sort of classify it in two ways. I'd say the first set of dangers relates to the higher doses of steroids that are typically given when physicians choose the intravenous route. And I should make it clear that there's no reason that an IV route has to beget, you know, high doses of steroids. It's just what we observe, that, yeah, you know, 95 times out of 100, if people were putting in an IV, they were also prescribing high doses of steroids. So the first, you know, set of risks relates to the excessive steroid exposure, and there are short-term risks and longer-term risks with repeated exposure. So, you know, over the short-term, patients getting high-dose steroids can have worsening of their diabetes or their glycemic control. They can suffer mild to moderate psychiatric abnormalities, anxiety, insomnia, hypomania. And over the longer term, with repeated exposures, and keeping in mind that patients with COPD can be hospitalized frequently, there's a risk of immune suppression and osteoporosis and, you know, all sorts of other undesirable side effects related to steroids. And then, you know, the other more pedestrian but, you know, important issue nonetheless is that, you know, if it's possible to avoid putting an intravenous line into a patient, that's probably a good thing, because we know that intravenous lines are uncomfortable and you know, reduce patient mobility within the hospital, and themselves are a nidus of infection, of thrombosis, and then, you know, are costly to manage from the standpoint of nursing time. But those are the two things that I sort of see as the opportunities in terms of practice change and improvements in care for patients as a result of this study would be, you know, reducing exposure to potentially unnecessary steroids, and number two, eliminating the need for an intravenous line, at least in some cases.
Are you expecting to see changes in your hospital group as a result?
Well, you know, I think it's the kind of thing that people should be, you know, discussing at their weekly or monthly business meetings or practice management meetings, and thinking about under what circumstances patients should be considered for a trial or treatment with oral steroids, and when when intravenous steroids make sense. Mm. And it's gives me an opportunity to also point out a finding of the study was that one out of five patients who were started on oral steroids were later switched to intravenous therapy. And, you know, while we didn't know precisely why that change was made, it was something that we noted and, you know, might indicate that for some patients the low-dose oral route was perceived to not be working.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something I suppose that physicians could kind of keep in their back pocket in the face of clinical deterioration. But again, I think, you know, one of the things to remember about this study, which at the end of the day may be the most kind of reassuring piece, is that what we found was that our results were consistent with the recommendations contained in guidelines. And you said that at the start. I think we would have been in a much more tricky position with respect to arguing about how folks should interpret the results if our results, in fact, were contradictory to the recommendations contained in the guidelines.
Thank you. I want to thank you for your time with us
Sure.
today, Dr. Lindenauer.
Happy to join you, and thanks for the invitation.
Drop me a note. Let me know how we're doing. My email address is jelia, J-E-L-I-A, at jwatch.org. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-617-440-4374. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org, where links for all news stories can also be found. Go to the Journal Watch site, which is jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Isidore Yano, and I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. Thanks for listening.